to recognize what has not moved, what is unaffected by any activity, any emotional state, any circumstance. This is your refuge. This is what is always still. This is where communion is awaiting your attention. Communion is awaiting attention, self to self. Since it is present always, since it is eternally here, it is here for you to experience. You are that which is eternally here, eternally present. It's time to meet yourself now. In my meeting with people these past 6 years, my formal satsangs, I've discovered several questions that reoccur. I would say the most frequently asked question has to do with emotions, with how to get rid of or be free from the difficult emotions such as anger and grief, and how to get more of the pleasant emotions such as joy, happiness. In our Western psychology, we are trained in many different ways, but usually our strategies are directed to either repressing negative emotions or expressing negative emotions in the hope that they will be released or will be pushed out of sight. Finally, neither of those ways reflect the truth of your inherent self, which is unaffected by any emotion. So my suggestion is to neither repress any emotion nor express any emotion. I don't mean this as a technique. Certainly there are times when it is absolutely appropriate to repress an emotion, as there are times when it is absolutely appropriate to express an emotion. But in this moment of satsang, there is the opportunity to realize when emotion is neither repressed nor expressed, what is the meeting with emotion? This I call direct experience. So in neither denying this so-called difficult emotion, such as anger or grief or fear, sadness, in neither denying it nor wallowing in it, then there can be no story about it. There can be no storyline about who it's happening to and why it's happening and why it should not be happening and who's responsible and who's to blame and how to keep it away and what to do next. So, for instance, if someone is experiencing some irritation, the usual tendency is to do something to get rid of this irritation or to find some blame to place either on oneself or on someone else as the cause, or on what was eaten, or how the parent raised the child. These are all the storylines around irritation. It's actually possible to not do anything with irritation, to not push it out of awareness, to not get rid of it, but to simply, in the moment, be completely, totally, freely irritated, without speaking it, without keeping it hidden, just being irritated. In general, that will in fact reveal something deeper than irritation. Irritation was perhaps a surface ripple. Deeper than irritation, maybe will be exposed some fear, some unseen fear, some subconscious fear, not to be gotten rid of, not to be analyzed, but to be directly experienced. So in the moment that perhaps fear is experienced, to be absolutely, completely fearful. This is a big one. This is a big challenge. It is fear that we keep away. And of course, in this attempt to keep fear away, it grows larger. It hovers closer. So I'm suggesting that you can actually open to fear. You can actually experience being afraid without any need to say afraid of what or any following of the thought. But if I really experience, just to simply experience, then perhaps there is even a deeper emotion revealing itself. Maybe some deep sadness or hurt. This too can be directly, completely experienced with no need of storyline. If you are willing to experience these emotional layers, finally you will approach a deep abyss, or what appears to the mind as a deep abyss, or even a black hole. This is what the mind perceives as nothingness, as emptiness, as no-bodiness. This is a very important moment. To be willing to be absolutely nothing, nobody, is to be willing to be free, is to recognize in truth what this nothing, no-bodiness is. And all of these other emotional states are layers of defense against this experience. It is this experience that is the experience of death that leads to or reveals true self-inquiry. Once the defenses are down, once the door is open, then this nothingness that has been run from in the mind is met fully. And this nothingness in this meeting reveals the secret gem of truth that has been hidden in the core of your own pocket all this time. So once again, in this willingness to directly experience what is arising, in this case, a difficult emotion, there is the opportunity for direct self-inquiry, for not moving into what is common or usual, such as some story about me and my emotion, but instead simply discovering anger, grief, sadness, fear, directly, with no movement. I have to tell you, it is a great discovery. And then I have to tell you, you have to discover this for yourself. It's very easy to hear someone say, oh, just experience it. And that is what I'm saying, oh, just experience it. Just experience it deeply, completely. And then you will discover that in the core of any emotional state, there is the same pristine awareness meeting itself as both experiencer and experienced. You must discover this. I'm happy to encourage you with my words, but you must have this direct discovery firsthand so that you will be freed from running from so-called negative states and from running toward so-called positive states, so that you will be freed from this clinging to what is inherently impermanent, so that you will be freed to meet yourself. No thing meets no thing and rejoices in this meeting, overflows in the direct experience of no thing, whether this no thing is emotional, whether this no thing is mental, in particular the mental I thought I am the body, or whether this no thing is realized to be circumstantial, some event. So whatever arises in consciousness, in awareness, can be met fully by consciousness, by awareness, with no need to hide in story, about event, around event, in analysis of event. The meeting is possible now. all the analysis, all of the stories, while not being wrong in any way, can never give you this meeting. This meeting is yours freely, because it is a meeting of your own self with itself. People always wonder, then how does this work in my relationships, in particular in my love relationships? Well, if you can meet your relationship as you meet yourself, then you will see the flowering of the potential of what we call love relationships. Then relationships are not in fact relationships. They are in fact oneself discovering oneself deeper in different form, in different manifestation. Then these so-called relationships are vehicles for the deepest truth. Usually relationships, unfortunately, are not based on discovering truth. Usually they're based on some kind of furtherance of the maintenance of this I thought, so that a lover may take a lover because the lover promises some security, promises some joining of this I thought, some alliance, so that the I thought can be protected from the rest of the world. In other words, usually relationships are quite neurotic. But the potential, even for neurosis, is to discover who is in relationship, who loves, and in that, to discover what is permanent, while the manifestations of this love are inherently impermanent. Parents die. Children die. Lovers die. Love does not die. Love meets itself again and again and again. Permanence meets itself again and again and again, penetrating every impermanent relationship. If one is willing to love purely, then one is willing for birth and death to occur, because one is willing to be that which one loves, which is in fact love. To be love is to be no thing in particular, is to not be clinging to anything in particular. Of course, what gets called love is egoic love, is a sentimental imitation of love, and it has to do with very much suffering. But what is true love does not cast suffering out, but embraces suffering to such a degree that suffering itself falls down, prostrate, bowing to the mystery and the magnificence and the permanence of love, while all of the objects of love come and go. This is the true marriage. When you as mind stream meet truth as ocean of love and bow before that and vow to serve that, this is true marriage, and this is a true life that is lived in that marriage, in that service. I'd like to talk a little more about relationships, since this is where most people feel their attachments and their suffering. And you know, the basic problem in relationships is that you're trying to get something from someone else that is already present within you. This is reflected in parent-child relationship, where a parent may hope that the child will finally give the parent fulfillment that it didn't experience, or the child hopes that the parent will give it fulfillment. And it gets played out as adults in our matings, with all the attendant attitudes of suffering, such as jealousy, fears of abandonment, anger, possessiveness, suffering in general, The opportunity in relationship is when these feelings arise after the first honeymoon of falling in love passes. When these feelings arise, the opportunity is to really not focus outside on other, the mate, to see how it can be fixed, but actually to turn inward and be willing to directly experience whatever it is being avoided. So that if jealousy is a problem, if this arises, even if the partner is playing some covert or overt role in evoking this jealousy, just for the moment, rather than addressing the role the partner may be playing, if you can simply turn inside and experience fully, without moving, this jealous state. Under jealousy is something deeper, that the jealousy is some kind of defense against. Jealousy seems to me to be composed of fear and anger. So under the jealousy, there is a more primal emotion that can be directly experienced. And in the willingness to experience this, all kinds of insights may arise in terms of how you were treated as a child or what your first relationship was like with a lover. And that's interesting and can even be helpful. But if the focus is on simply experiencing what is being avoided, you will see then the jealousy, the role of jealousy, is to somehow keep your attention away from experiencing that fear or grief or abandonment or abyss of emptiness. And you will have the opportunity to actually experience that. When you are willing to experience ultimately emptiness, nothingness, then you are already free. Because all of the strategies are some kind of movement away from that experience. So this invitation is to experience that which all strategies work to keep you from experiencing. You experience that, and the truth is, in your direct experience of that, you realize boundless freedom. You realize that which you are searching for in this other is present right here where you are. Regardless of other, and certainly regardless of other activity, then naturally there is clarity. And whether you are to get rid of the lover or whether you are to be clear with the lover in terms of what boundaries must be set, in terms of what activity is acceptable or unacceptable, this all naturally comes from this deep insight of the truth of who you are. So what I'm saying is that this love that you are searching for everywhere is already present within you. It may be evoked by any number of events or any presence. A mountain can invoke this love. A sunset can invoke this love. Your beloved can evoke this love. Your guru can evoke this love. But finally, to realize you are this love, you have to be willing to follow where the evoking is pointing. And that is within you, that source of love. So in that sense, even the worst relationships are great teachers or great vehicles for the true teacher, the Satguru. I'm not condoning abusive relationships. Sometimes people misunderstand this and assume that I'm saying, well, you just accept whatever your partner does to you. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that clarity in relationship is responsibility. And responsibility, the very meaning of the word, is the ability to respond, not based on past, not based on fear, not based on control of other. So in your willingness to just stop for one moment and not follow the workings of the mind into attaching blame or attaching outcome and to attaching analysis, just to be still and completely experience what is arising. When you completely experience it without repressing it, without acting it out, you will see that it is nothing, that the jealousy or whatever other evoked emotion was only held together by thought, whether this thought be conscious thought or subconscious thought, pre-verbal thought. That's what holds together, that's the glue that holds these not quite primal emotions such as jealousy, anxiety, worry, holds guilt, holds those together. And when you are willing to cut the story and experience what is under the guilt, under the jealousy, under the anxiety, under the worry, then you have the opportunity to really directly experience pure emotion. And from that, you have the opportunity to experience pure emotionlessness. You know, in our culture in particular, people are quite happy to experience emotions somewhat, because there's a sense of depth and a sense of freedom. But often this willingness to experience emotions is a cover for the fear of experiencing no emotion whatsoever. We have defined ourselves as emotional beings, and perhaps that is a step deeper than defining yourself as a purely mental being, but it is not all the way home. And what is avoided in defining yourself as an emotional being is this emotionlessness, this nothing, this emptiness. So that is the invitation. And when you are willing to experience that, and when you have experienced that, you know directly that who you are cannot be defined by any state of either emotion or non-emotion. And this is freedom. Then there's freedom for emotions to arise. They don't mean anything about who you are. And there's freedom for no motion, emotion to arise. The arising of no emotion also means nothing about who you are. Then you know directly that these emotional states, or these states of no emotion, are simply passing through who you are. This is self-inquiry. This is self-inquiry that is dealing directly with emotional states. And this is available for you. If your relationships are going well, it's available. If your relationships are not going well, it's available. Also, another question that is often asked is about work, such as, is it possible to realize your true self while working a regular job? Yes, definitely. It is possible. So you can remove that excuse from your notebook of excuses of why you can't quite realize your true self yet. It has nothing to do with your job. It is traditional, of course, for people to withdraw from jobs, from work, from daily life, to retreat. And we have, of course, in all cultures, monastic communities. Yet, even in these monastic communities, there is the torment of the mind. So the retreat that is essential, at least for one instant in a lifetime, the essential retreat is the conscious retreating from everything, from your job, from your relationship, from your name, from your culture, from your religious aspirations, from your hopes, from your fears, and more. Retreating from everything for one instant. This is what Ramana means when he gives his essential teaching, be still. Be still. This is retreat. You experience this in one instant, and you experience yourself as you are, unclothed by any idea of who you are. You experience this in this one instant, and you realize where retreat is. Then, regardless of your job, your work, your daily activities, this retreat is available for you. You didn't have to go anywhere to attend this retreat. This is the attendance to that which is always still within you, that which is always quiet. This can happen, must happen, finally, in the midst of the busiest day. There's nothing wrong with taking time out for retreat. It's a great luxury, and it is certainly one that you have earned. People have said, but I can't even take an instant. I can't take a second. And yet, if you just take this 1 second, even your work benefits from that. Certainly your relationships benefit from that. Then if you have the time and the wherewithal, yes, it's quite wonderful to take a physical retreat, to take what's called a vacation or a holiday, to be away from your day-to-day activities. So then you can see, actually, what your day-to-day mind activity is. Often our day-to-day work activities obscure what is going on in the mind, what is going on underneath the usual working thoughts. So this 1 instant of retreat is essential. And if you have time to take a longer retreat, a day, a week, a month, where you can be in some quiet place, where you can relax, where you can be still in your physical body as well as your mental body and your emotional body, then this is a great luxury. It's a great gift. It's a boon. But it is not essential for your liberation. In terms of the type of work, or what has been called by the Buddhist right livelihood, if you will first be still within yourself, then you can discover in clarity how intolerable it is to perform work that is somehow anti or against the realization of truth. The suffering that has been repressed while a work that has caused harm to others has been performed is revealed, and you will no longer be able to function if your work is actually causing harm to others. I don't know if you saw this popular movie, Schindler's List, but it's a very good example. This was a man who was definitely not spiritual, was only interested in his money, and he saw a good opportunity to make a lot of money with the slave labor from the Jewish population at Hitler's concentration camps. And he did profit by that slave labor. But at a certain point, at some kind of mysterious point in his life, he could no longer perform that. Even though it meant he would lose his fortune and he possibly could lose his life, he simply could no longer perform it. It is a mystery how this occurred for him. But if, in fact, your work or your livelihood is in question in your mind, then it is only self-respectful for you to take one moment and be absolutely clear so that you can be encouraged to stop work if, in fact, it's benefiting from others' harm. Then you will see that simple work, or work that you might have thought was in fact stopping you from liberation, is in fact not stopping you from anything. So I often speak to people about the great joy of being secret agents in service of the truth, so that if you find yourself being a cashier at a checkout counter, or a librarian, or a policeman, or a doctor, or a lawyer, or a teacher, or a parent, or a student, or a child, then this is your work. And within that work, you can live and speak and be the truth. Then that work is transformed without needing to make any change. When you are willing to live and speak and be the truth, then whatever work comes your way is true work, is a vehicle for reaching other aspects of yourself, other people, and offering them the same opportunity to live one's life fully in service to this mystery that one is. So then, of course, activities that happen in work, the relationship with work, is the same answer as the relationship with the mate or the beloved. It's always all coming back to this willingness to experience what has not been experienced. This willingness to see, willingness to be still. Finally, it is the willingness to be nothing at all. I will tell you a story of how my teacher cut through this question very quickly, given all what I have just said. this question arose for him once, and he brought several of us into his room, and he said, "So, how would you answer this question?" And he read the question aloud, which was someone complaining because they lived over an auto body shop. This was in India, so of course the auto body shop was operating 24 hours a day, and the person never got to meditate, and he was quite frustrated, and he wrote Papaji, Punjaji, to say, "What should I do?" So Papaji presented this question to us, and he looked at me and he said, "So, Gangaji, what do you say?" And I said, "Well, I would tell him to discover that which is eternally quiet within him, and then nothing can disturb that." And he said, "Okay." And he asked someone else, and they also gave a beautiful answer. He asked two or three of us, and then he put the question aside. The next day in satsang, in Papaji's formal satsang, he read this question aloud and he brought this man up front. He read this question aloud and he brought this man up front. And he said, "I gave this question to several people and they gave me very good answers, but they didn't give me the true answer." And he said, "You live on top of an auto body shop which is going 24 hours a day and you want to know how you can meditate. I'll tell you, move. Move. Why do you stay there? It's so obvious. And it is so obvious. And it is so simple. And it is so clear. So if you find yourself in a situation which does not support the truth of who you are, drop it. Move it. You have nothing to lose but your protection from fear. Very good. Drop whatever is protecting you from fear. Face the fear. Then you will discover that nothing can keep you from that which is free and quiet and still. It may mean leaving your job. It may mean leaving a comfortable lifestyle. It may mean traveling to the mountaintop. But what does that matter? If what you are truly seeking is the truth, whatever it means, follow the Satguru, the truth that is within your own being, regardless of comfort or discomfort, regardless of approval or disapproval of the culture. This desire to be free faces a momentous onslaught of conditioned existence, and the world, the culture, religion, families, workplaces, status, all goes into keeping you from realizing yourself. So there's a certain point where you have to be willing to be naked in the world, where you have to be willing to not know what your job should be, not know where you should be, not know who you should see, just to be open, just to be quiet, so that these demons of fear and anxiety and worry and the resulting activity of selling out and ignoring the truth of the Satguru, these activities can be done with. I am encouraging you to live a life that is in service to the deepest truth of your being, and to always be willing for that truth to reveal itself as deeper and deeper. It is my guarantee that the truth reveals itself deeper and deeper. It is my teacher's guarantee, and it is his teacher's guarantee. Now it is up to you to see what your life is a guarantee of. It's time for you now to see. You know, I am not teaching you a religion. This teaching actually has nothing to do with religion. You may be very happy with your religion, and this teaching has nothing to do with dispelling that happiness. You may enjoy your rituals, the practices of your religion, singing God's name, going through certain motions. There's nothing wrong with any of that. If you are interested in freedom, if you are interested in realizing the Christ that is alive in your heart, the Buddha that is your open, clear mind, then you have to finally leave behind all known practices, all known religions, at least for one instant. If these religions and these practices return, and you like them, you are free to practice them. But once you have experienced that which is untouched by any religion or any practice, or any past or any future, then your religion, your practices, your rituals are a celebration rather than a searching for some fulfillment. It is a celebration of the fulfillment that is revealed. This is the living truth, the living Christ, the living Buddha. Then your words are sutras. Then you read scripture and you recognize, yes, I know that to be true. Very different from saying, yes, I certainly hope that is true, or I don't know how that could be true, or I don't understand that. You know it to be true because it is your own heart speaking. So, while there is no problem with religions per se, there is a problem if what you want is freedom and you are looking for it in a ritual. Freedom is free. It is not held any place. It is not held in these words. It is not held in any words. These words and many religious words and many spiritual words and many rituals and practices point to that which is fully, completely free. They point to who you are. Discover that and then see. I have been asked if I am a guru or a head of a church or a head of a religion. I am definitely not a head of a religion, not a head of a church. And guru? Well, I don't know if I'm a guru. That's up to you. I told you at the beginning who I am. I am your own self. If you like to think of me a guru, that's up to you. If you like to think of me a sister, that's up to you. If you like to think of me as just some disembodied voice speaking to you through the marvels of technology, that's up to you. It doesn't matter to me. You can even think of me as your enemy. It doesn't matter. My function is to speak truly to you what I have realized. That's an invitation for you to speak truly to me what you have realized. And then your realization expands my realization. My realization expands your realization. And realization is realized to be the supreme non-activity of the mind, of the self. That's the function of a true teacher. People have often asked me what my life is like now, what my everyday experience is like. My life is very ordinary. My life is not an extraordinary life in terms of day-to-day activity. I have certain things I like. I like to walk. I like to swim. I enjoy a good movie. I like a good meal. I love being in nature. And I enjoy the activity of the marketplace often. How these teachings have changed my life is radical. Before I met Papaji, before, through his grace, my mind was stopped so that I could realize the truth of my being, every activity in this life was a searching for some fulfillment or self-definition, whether it was searching in the bliss of being in nature, or in the bliss of relationship, or in the mundane bliss of acquisition. It was always a searching for who am I, and always a searching for a positive answer to that, and a running from the negative answer to that. I'm not searching for that now. I know, and I realize deeper every day, that no thing can define me, that I have a great, the joy, the pleasure of being in a beautiful, powerful spot in nature, or however harmonious the relationship, or delightful the experience in the marketplace. That from which it all arises is so much greater, is so much more profound, more blissful, more harmonious, more sublime. Of course, in realizing that, then the most ordinary events are a reflection of that sublime mystery. So my day-to-day life, while being very ordinary on the outside, is one of deep reverence for my teacher, who pointed me in this direction, for his teacher, who continues to deepen the pointing, and for all aspects of myself, including you listening to this, who evoke deeper and deeper realization while challenging the speaking of this realization, while playing in the lila of this realization, just in day-to-day activities, just in walking down the street, just in eyes meeting, just for an instant, no need of any personal relationship, no need of any conquest, no need of reaching for fulfillment. Then fulfillment is continually overflowing. When I say my teacher stopped my mind, I mean that in the force of his grace, the habitual, obsessive mind activity was stopped. It could not continue. There was a force greater than the momentum of the habit of my obsessive thinking about myself. What should I do now? Am I doing it correctly? Why did this happen? Why didn't this happen? All of that stopped. And the unspeakable mystery revealed itself to be always present. Now, I'm not saying I don't have a mind, and I'm not saying I don't have mind activity. But once the mind has stopped, the activity that is generated from the mind is no longer believed to be the final reality. So that now I'm quite happy to have a mind, and I'm also quite happy to have wonderful periods of no mind activity. I'm not even saying the mind activity is the problem. In itself, it's not a problem. It's simply mind activity. But in our conditioning and in our belief that mind activity is in fact reality, there is the problem. Because this mind activity feeds on itself into enormous complexity of suffering, always searching for who am I, but searching in all the wrong places, searching in thoughts upon thoughts upon thoughts, searching in objects, from the obvious kind of search of a teenager acquiring a new car to the also obvious search of finding a new lover, finding a better job, finding a different teacher, changing, shifting, always searching for who am I, until finally a great teaching or a great teacher with its enormous force stops that activity. And you can, and you must, and you will, at that moment, discover directly this jewel that is alive in the core of your being. Before I met my teacher, before he guided me deeper within myself, I would say that my life was lived on a ground of suffering. There were great highlights of joy and pleasure. In meeting him and in having him stop my mind, there was a flip. So that now my life is lived on a ground of joy. There are moments of unhappiness. There are moments of anger. There are moments of distress. There are moods that pass through. And yet it is all on this ground of joy. There is no mood that need be feared. There is no moment that need be avoided. Finally, I see that it all points back to that source of everything, that sky of consciousness. That sky is the truth of who you are. And it is my deepest wish that you realize this for yourself. And in this realization, that you then share this with everyone, verbally or not verbally, but sharing it in your being with everyone who comes near you or even hears of you. It is with that wish that I say thank you. Welcome to Thought Zone. Where's Carol, who wrote this letter? Very good. My first day of silence has been fraught with a mixture of peace and frustration. Trying to negotiate what I'm doing with a good friend while not speaking has been like the worst part of a marriage. However, yesterday was equally frustrating with conversation present. That says something, doesn't it? In the evening satsang, a strong theme was that peace was present, is present, before, during, and after frustration. One must allow frustration to come and go in order to not suffer. I am feeling now this great sense of nothing mattering that is so peaceful as I again write to the sound of Willow Creek. I do not have to be looking at your face or hearing your wonderful eternal speech to be eternity. I am that in my own room, in my own cell, just with me. Excellent. So you may wonder what you're all doing here if you don't need to hear me. Because you cannot escape me. I am your own self. I cannot escape you. You are my own self. And one uses oneself to deepen in the realization of that. However one appears, as person, as creek, as frustration, doesn't matter. Here I is. Good. Dear Gangaji, where's Spar? Interesting first sentence. Is sex, relationship, and peace possible for me? Well, I would say that if sex, relationship, and peace is possible, it's only if you let go of this me. So very simple. You just drop one of those. You talk of removing the obstacles to peace. Not exactly. What I said is you must see what you think is the obstacle to peace. Or what you think is the vehicle to peace. And let them both go. And see if peace itself is affected in any way. You understand the difference? It's not a removing, it's a recognition that whatever obstacle we imagine or whatever vehicle we imagine is only imagination. And that imagination is held together by this linchpin called ME. Right? Yes, good. Retreating from the patterns of my mind, addicted to false identification. On Saturday night, you talked about sex and relationship. This appears to hold many obstacles to peace for me. Yes, I would say that could be a general appearance. Or a vehicle. Sex and relationship as obstacle, sex and relationship as vehicle. That's the trap. With regard to my sexual feelings, I know that I have repressed them and repressed them for many, many years. The intensity of the feelings, the intensity of being that open, vulnerable, trusting, intimate with myself, my feelings, my sexuality, my heart in the presence of another, has been traded for the fear of these more often than not. It gets more complicated for me when I feel loving attraction, sexual attraction, to women other than the woman I am living with. That's a familiar complication, isn't it? As either obstacle or vehicle. I feel afraid to admit these feelings arise, ashamed that I am so fickle, terrified that I might surrender to my desire and be disloyal to my partner 5 years. I feel unlovable for the way I feel. You talking of expressing my sexual feelings leave a knot in my stomach. I didn't say expressing your sexual feelings. Maybe I did. Saturday night? I did, but I was being very loose with my language. You say I can go into the core of this and find something more. I only find more confusion and fear. If you go into the core of this enormous sexual impulse and you find confusion, then that is a clue that you're not in the core. Confusion is in the mind. Confusion has to do with thoughts and trying to make order. So it also can be terrifying, of course, because with confusion there's the sense of the loss of order and the attempt to recreate or relocate order. And that's often a major distraction from simply sinking into the core. Let there be confusion. Let there be fear as you willingly open to this enormous charge of energy. That's the possibility. That's what I was speaking of. Yes, as you, so it goes on. This is all mind, control, morality, and guilt. To thicken the plot, I am terrified of having to endure the pain that I have felt when a woman I am in relationship with has a sexual relationship with another man. Not only am I fickle, I can experience tremendous jealousy, betrayal, rage, and pain when another does what I have wanted to do. There must be light and love in me. Yes. How wonderful you can admit that finally. There must be. You can only say that if you know that to be true, even if you are far from experiencing it as true. You know it is true. There must be. In me, in my sexuality, in relationship, in expression, can you help me find it? And that which is beyond expression and repression of sexuality, what is that? Where is that? I want to be free. That's where that is. In freedom. You know, someone was speaking in here the other day about humanity and the fear that if one surrenders to this invitation of satsang, this invitation of not moving from that which is not moving toward repression, not moving toward expression, the fear that one will be less human. It's actually the fear that one will be less sexual, fear that one will be less desirable, the fear that one will be less of a citizen. It's an enormous fear because that conditioning is very deep. I don't mean just social conditioning, I mean biological, physiological conditioning. And also the very instinct of the herd, because humans are social animals, even though they have extreme antisocial tendencies. They're basically social animals. And the imperative for the human animal is to procreate itself, to ensure that the species survives. And in order for the species to survive and procreation to happen, it is the most desirable impulse. It is where, when it is fulfilled, there's a possibility of the experience of deep release of all tension, all searching, all desire, all identification with ME. And in that moment, there is rest, there is peace. So it's very interesting that this is tied into the procreation of the species. A little suspicious, too. But it is, obviously. It is. And in truth, there's no problem with it. The only problem arises, and it invariably seems to arise, in the identification that who you are is the species. Who you are is what must be procreated. Who you are is what must be fulfilled. And this is major. This is identification, misidentification with body, with maleness, with sexual arising, with all of the conditioning that goes with that, including for a male in particular, finding multiple partners so that procreation is ensured even more, and with protecting and hoarding partner. But who you are is not that. And there arises a time within a human being where that which is beyond the human being is calling to be known. And this is the time in this lifetime, obviously, or you wouldn't be sitting here in satsang. And that is a time of extreme challenge and extreme opportunity. And this sexual impulse at this stage in your life, which is still viable sexually, is a very big force that can be experienced as an enormous obstacle, has been experienced as an enormous obstacle, either in repression, which you have experienced, or in acting out, which many of your brothers and sisters have experienced. One, the repression has to do with very much pain. The acting out has to do with very much pleasure. Both experienced as somehow obstacles because both have within them the re-stimulating effect of identification of yourself, of who you are, as this particular body, as these particular impulses, as a species. Because that's what has worked for procreation. So it is strong, and it must be honored as extremely strong. And the truth is, there's nothing wrong with repression. There's nothing wrong with acting out. But in most cases, when there's a habit of repression and a habit of acting out, there's an overlooking of that which is inherently pure, fulfilled, at peace, at rest in itself, with no me or body attached. And so I have often suggested that when this enormous impulse arises, this sexual desire, in whatever context, appropriate or inappropriate, that it is possible to actually not move, to not move the mind in the direction of repression and to not move the mind in the direction of expression or acting out, to simply burn up in that impulse, because the whole impulse is saying go, and the reply to that is either yes or no. But when there is no reply, there is simply the willingness to burn, to let the whole body shake, the whole psyche and all of its, yes, I must, no, I shouldn't, yes, yes, to let all of that just explode. This is what the Buddha teaches, not in any morality teaching, but in the willingness to be absolutely, completely still, regardless of the tidal wave that comes, regardless of the hurricane that comes. To be still, do not move, regardless of whether you are with a legitimate partner or an illegitimate partner. Do not move. This is an opportunity most people can experience, because most people have, at least in your age group, at least from age 4 or 5 to somewhere between 50 and 80, this desire arising. So, it's not for me or any teacher to tell you what you should do. But as your own self, and as a human being who was deeply identified sexually for a number of years, probably beginning at age 4, and realizing psychically this is a way to get ahead, this is a way to get approval, this is a way to get a very good position in the herd. As a woman, this is a way to get a head man. This is all very basic stuff. Until finally there is a crack where the position has either been so good or never good enough, and the man so good or never good enough, that there's a willingness to see, what is this really? Deeper than this injunction to express it. And I can tell you that I was at